the tannages can make a real difference, because I'm sure you've handled leather where you touch it and you're like, ew. Or you're like, ah. I mean, that's just a factor of the time and effort by whoever produced that leather to make it into something that made it very, very unique and wonderful versus somebody who cut a corner. And you can actually tell by touching it and looking at it.
Shoecast. Oh, hey there. Welcome to the Stitch Down Shoecast, where we talk quality footwear, how it's made, and all the things we love about it. I'm Ben from StitchDown.com, and oh, don't you know, today I'm talking with Egg Galoon, a fifth-generation leather tanner who has reignited Galoon Leathers, the founded in 1858 Milwaukee powerhouse that was one of the largest tanneries in the U.S. for a major stretch of the 20th century, before shuttering in the 90s. Well, thanks to Ed, Galoon is back. And they're making some legitimately remarkable leather in Wisconsin all over again. I'm hugely excited to talk to Ed about Galoon's past, present, and future. But before that, we need to give a loving Shoecast shout out to our sponsor this week, Nick's Boots, who Ed is working with and are literally days away from unveiling an aggressively cool secret project at our boot camp World's Fair of Footwear in Brooklyn this October 6th and 7th. Galoon will be there too. And you should also be there at boot camp. Come to boot camp. Or don't come and just keep staying tuned to Nick's channels and Ed's channels and all that. Although that means you would miss out on a fabulous collective of community and makers and free beer from Untitled Art. Also from Wisconsin. This is highly Wisconsin-centric, this episode. You choose, but we hope to see you there. All right, let's bring him out. Egg Galoon of Galoon Leathers. Welcome to the Shoecast. How are you doing? And what are you wearing on your feet today, my man?
Hey, Ben. Thanks for having me. Today, I've got a pair of very comfortable tennis shoes on, my Jack Purcells in white milled leather, just a very standard and staple product that I like to wear and can stand in all day.
Better than canvas.
But I think so.
So, Ed, really excited to talk about everything, but let's throw it way back to start out. You relaunched Galoon about a year ago. We're going to hear all about it. 1858. That's when your family tannery started in Milwaukee. You remember all of that, right?
No, none of it, but I've been very aware of it for a very long time. Yeah, I'm fifth generation of the family that stayed in the leather business. Yeah, I guess that would be my great-great-great-great-grandfather. If we go back far enough. Yeah, 1858, he emigrated from the Harz Mountain region of Germany and made it over as an apprentice and moved his way to Milwaukee, started a tannery. For me, it's fun to be able to look back and really kind of awe-inspiring that I've been lucky enough to be associated with something that's been around that long.
So you sent me over this incredible document. It was a 100th anniversary, I guess, in 1958, that Galoon put together like a small book, essentially, about the tannery's history and got really specific. We've got that. There are actually a couple of things that I want to read directly from that in a little bit here. But what else do you know, you know, either from that or wherever, about what was going on in tanning in Wisconsin in 1858? When this all started, the larger scene, Galoon specifically, what was happening?
What I get is a second and third hand from my family, but it was a much smaller need-based tanning operation. You know, obviously people needed shoes, but there a lot of harness work, a lot of products that required leather were tanned in more of a utilitarian basis versus fashion basis. So these products that were being tanned were all in need for local shoe guys, local harness makers. So the process was more in demand and very utilitarian. I mean, they did not make fashion colors. It was natural brown and black. I mean, it was very, very basic stuff back
then. Let's actually skip ahead then to some of this historical Galoon document that you sent me. This is one of the ones that I wanted to highlight. So this is from that. One of the more important changes of the last century, and remember this is 1958, in the leather industry has been the greater use of color. From one or two shades of brown, along with the staple black, variety of colors have come to be used, even more than those. And today, a wide range of colors and types of leather is essential for the maintenance of front rank position in the industry. Present demands call for a never-ending search for the new and novel in color style to satisfy the mercurial world of fashion in both men's and women's shoes and accessory items. This seems like kind of a new thing in 1958. There were literally like two colors.
the fashion for men's and women's footwear started to come a little bit more to the forefront rather than just something to cover your feet in. People started, you know, and I think it had a little bit to do with wealth. I think the economy started to grow to a point where people had disposable income. So fashion became a staple part of it. So, you know, in order to help people have nicer shoes and more interesting flat goods and belts and what have you, there was a concerted effort made to offer different things to the industry. Some of the advertising I've seen from back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s that, you know, I've been scouring the internet looking for as much as I can find with our old brand products. The later years, it starts getting way more interesting, the fashion colors and the textures and the different options available.
Yeah, I imagine, you know, it's like a post-war thing a little bit, and people are kind of less focused on that and starting to enjoy themselves a little bit. I don't know. It stands to reason, I guess, when you read this, but yeah, there were two whole shades of brown and a black back then. 1858, I mean, we're predating Goodyear welting. One of the things I guess I love about leather and tanning is that so many of these processes, like, are just what they are, have only changed so much. Do you understand what things were like back then versus now in terms of how leather was made?
The original tannery, where it was all vats, it was all vegetable tanned leather done in vats with local barks. I mean, it was literally the most basic, simple version of tanning. The process was very, very rudimentary. I mean, there was a mention in that brochure where they claim that my ancestors tanned chamois leather for Napoleon's army, which, okay, I can't go back and prove that.
For pants, chamois pants.
Allegedly. So I probably would look that akin to a lederhosen type apparatus, but I'm not sure. But I look at that and I'm like, okay, but the tanning back then, the technologies, the chemicals just weren't there. So they were having to use natural products in the process. So the processes that were here in Milwaukee, I have to be left to assume that the vat tanning was done the same identical way. And then the evolution of chemistry got better through time to make things more efficient and volume capable.
You know, as things progress, obviously, Galoon just grew into this absolute titan, which I think is the word that we use in the print interview on sitchdown.com that Josh did with you, I guess about a year ago at this point. There's this picture of the tannery and it is massive. It's just this huge, beautiful deco looking building. What happened between 1858 and then that you know about to see that kind of growth?
There was an area in Milwaukee called Tannery Row, which, I don't know, half a dozen or so buildings, almost identical, that were all tanneries that were built with kind of a small modification. I think the processes over the time and need became such that they decided to open another facility, which they eventually moved over to Water Street. Yeah, that building that was built there, I found the original plans with the Wisconsin Historical Society, which I'm trying to get copies made right now, but they're in such a state that it's going to take a little bit to get these done. But I'm going to have them just for my own personal deal. I just think they're cool. That building was north of 700,000 square feet by the time it was done. And back then, they'd build one building, need more space, build it right next to it. So it looked like a series of buildings built side to side to side to side. And as they needed it, it just expanded. You know, it looks better in drawing form than it does than it did in the day, because there was so much additions being made to it as time went. It's still standing today. They're actually, it's Galoon Tannery Row. It's condominiums now.
No way. Really? Are they good?
Yeah, they're great. I think there's 33 condominiums there. The one that I'd like to get my hands back on, if I can ever figure out a good reason why, is the main office that my great-grandfather, grandfather, and father used. We shut it down before I got a chance to move in there.
So somebody's living in what should be your office.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's got actually imported wood from Germany that's, you know, 8 inches thick. It's this crazy-looking thing. It looks unlike anything you see in today's world. It's pretty impressive.
I feel like you should have a claim to that.
Someone will certainly charge me enough for it if I really want to get my hands on it.
So this huge building, 700,000 square feet. What era was that? Like, do you know the decade?
I know the office warehouse building was built in 1894. So it was over a series of probably 20 years that that expanded to that level. I know from the Hyde House aspect, that started as a two-floor building, and then the demand for holding hides got to the point where they needed a lot more, and they ended up building a 6 or 7 story structure. I spoke with my father a little bit briefly about this, but they'd hold 2 to 3 weeks worth of production in that facility to keep ahead of it. They bought every day. Even when I was there, there were truckloads of calves being delivered 2-3 times a day. But as demand developed, and the war effort was a big thing, we had a lot of military contracts. I think if you saw from that pamphlet I sent you, they won the Army Navy E Award, which means they were a preferred supplier. There were a lot of men that needed boots, so they just opened up the valve and just started making leather for the military. It was a never-ending supply of business there for a while.
What was being produced?
I'd say primarily it was calf, but we have made kid skin before. We've made pig skin in that facility. It was all demand driven. Calf, obviously, was always kind of a fashion forefront in the later years, but it was a very common commodity. You know, there was side leather and what have you. For whatever reason, they decided calf skin was the way to produce product. And it made a very high quality, lightweight article. It lended itself to making dress footwear. In the beginning, you know, they were making boots and a variety of other things out of the same exact leather.
Right. So like the military boots were calf leather.
Yeah. Shoes and boots were made out of calf leather.
I don't think I knew that. Both of the big wars.
I'm going to have to say maybe. I don't know. I don't know for sure. I could probably do a little harder dig with the help of the curator at the Wisconsin Historical Society to find out exactly if we've got any detail to that in all these. I mean, it's literally like 3 rooms full of documentation. It is so overwhelming.
We're going to have you back on.
I can task this guy because we had a fun day. We spent about 5 hours digging. We found a lot of stuff. It was cool. I found 2 sets of original formulas from our Cretan calf and our Mandarin calf. So I'm actually in the process of working with a gentleman and redoing 2 of these tannages to see what we can produce and how closely we can replicate it. Obviously, it won't be the same because the vats have long since been buried and disappeared. They're underneath some brand new apartment buildings. But the contents of those, I have them on paper. So we're going to see if we can replicate this in a drum format.
And can you get everything else in terms of like ingredients and all that? Is it mainly just the tanning vessel?
From the original format, we can. I mean, obviously, they're not done in the bulk way they used to be delivered in the back of a horse-drawn cart. I mean, now where they're actually coming in 50-pound bags, you know, they're probably much better quality and much more refined now. We remade one. I'm going to have it at boot camp, actually. It's our Mandarin calf. It's our first trial. I love it. I mean, it's just unbelievably round and buttery and just absolutely gorgeous. I'll have it there. I'll have it in 2 colors, black and cognac. So it'll be kind of fun.
I guess we'll consider cognac to be the second brown that was available. It's kind of brown. So we'll have pictures that we talked about, you know, some of these old tanneries. You keep calling it a pamphlet. I'm going to call it a small book because it deserves that, I think. We'll have all that up on the site on stitchdown.com with Ed's episode for everybody to check out while you're listening along. But zooming forward a little bit, when did you get involved and what did that look like at the start?
I'd obviously worked at the tannery on and off through high school and college, just picking up jobs, doing different things around there, getting a little bit more versed in the process. A lot of my early jobs were pretty unpopular ones, like unloading trucks with raw calfskins on them. They'd come in twined bundles. It was not a great job. Maybe he was trying to discourage me. I'm not sure. So I spent a few summers doing that. I got to actually work in the tannery, and I started on the raw and wet end working in the beam house. You know, as I got a little more familiar, I got to work in the tan yard a little bit with the chemists, which was great being able to learn that. And then I worked my way up into finishing. But right out of college, I ended up taking a job at the tannery thinking, you know, this could be interesting. And they were kind enough to let me train. Not in our tannery when I first started. I had had experience there, but they let me go to Europe for about 6 months. And I got to work with a facility up in Northampton called Tustin & Burnett. And then I got to spend a few more months at another tannery called Concierge Feira. 2 very polar opposite tanneries. One was very old school and original, and Concierge Feira was very, at the time, state of the art. So it gave me a good perspective on tanning, you know, in 2 different methodologies. You know, it was probably the average age of the tannery equipment in our facility and Tustin & Burnett were probably not too far apart from the standpoint of being multiple decades old, and then going into Concierge Feira, where they actually had a clean room in their urethane facility where you would walk in and wear booties and you actually have to go through a portal and get dusted off. It was impressive. impressive. Oh yeah. Yeah. It was a very different, very high tech environment, which, you know, I was 21, 22 years old. I thought this was cool. So coming back to the tannery at the end of the year was a bit of a letdown. Now what's old is cool. Then, you know, that was, to me, was kind of, hey, this is how all things should be.
I mean, it's like you're building a damn space shuttle, wearing white suits and all that.
Well, urethane traps dust, so they were very, very aware of it. But they made some unbelievably cool stuff there. I mean, high, high fashion.
Like what? Like, explain what cool means in this context.
Mostly patent leathers, but they'd come up with urethane effects that would make things look like a tortoiseshell look in urethane covered leather. These leathers were so off the charts, different than what I was used to producing at our tannery, where these were just, the urethanes alone were so soft and flexible. They'd put prints in it. They'd actually give an artificial depth that was done chemically. I mean, it literally, they'd roll these on and then they'd layer them up to the point where you'd have this almost iridescent depth to these leathers that would look like different colors when they turn. You know, this was in 1990. To me, this was almost like black magic compared to what we would do. We were spraying literally the most aniline thin light tops possible, trying not to cover anything. And these guys were rolling on urethane on top of leather. So it was a very different experience, but it was cool. I mean, I saw some things that I was just blown away by.
Okay, so you come back, you're heartbroken to leave the clean room.
Well, yes and no. I was a little homesick too, I'm not going to lie. So my Italian got better, but by no means, I wasn't quite conversational. I was close, but not quite.
When you come back, the Galoon Tannery is still operational at that point?
It was starting to get more difficult price-wise. We were getting some resistance. At that time, the Japanese were luxury brand obsessed, so they were buying calfskins. So the raw material market started forcing the price of our raw material up incredibly high, which started to freeze out some of our domestic customers. So they started looking for alternatives. So, you know, where we were at one point, we're probably running 250,000 feet a month, it dropped to about 100,000 feet a month without much warning. I mean, I would say over about a 6 to 8 month period, it just trickled down fast and we couldn't figure out why. And we realized it was the price pyramid. We're getting closer to the higher part of it. So next thing you know, we realized the higher we were getting, the less volume we were getting. And we had a very large facility. So it was hard to justify at one point. We had to seriously consider, what can we do? Where is there going to be customers that can afford this product? And at that point, we weren't sure what the answer to that was. We kept it going for another probably 2 years and maybe a year too long based on that business model. It just was a big, big building. If we would have been on our game a little bit better, maybe we would have downsized. We had a lot of land. We could have probably consolidated the manufacturing into a smaller facility, but that really was never brought up. I was pretty low on the totem pole, so that wasn't really...
It's not your fault, Ed.
No. But the decision was made. Well, it wasn't. I at that time, I was also working in the import side, so, which was thriving at that time.
So you mentioned just kind of these price fluctuations, right? There's another piece from the document you sent over that I want to read. This is the story of a firm which, during its long life, has had to adapt to a fluctuating raw stock market almost unheard of in any other industry. And remember, this is 1958. Raw stock prices that in the last 25 years have swung from a low of 5 cents a pound to a high of $1.25 a pound. The simple reason for this is, of course, that the tanner's raw stock is a byproduct of the meat and milk industries, and consequently, demand for leather has literally no influence on the slaughter of calves, which a lot of people don't know until they listen to this podcast, which is usually where it comes up, which is governed by the supply and demand for meat and milk. With other of the nation's tanners, Galoon constantly faces this special operating problem in its raw stock purchasing. That is such a wild swing from 5 cents to $1.25. Like, what a thing to contend with. And how much of a factor was that? And just the American tanning industry in general, you know, outside Horween and, you know, a handful of others, like, simply not existing anymore? Or was it other factors?
I think all of it played a part. My involvement around there when they were buying hides for calfskins, I mean, that was tracked on a historical level for a 10-year window. So they got a pretty good idea how things were going to move. But when things would move up unnaturally from what the markets had been, like I mentioned, the Japanese wanted calfskin really, really bad. So they bought them at all. And they started paying whatever price was offered. And of course, hide sellers were going to ride that wave as high as they could. And of course, we'd still purchase, and it's still a market, so we'd have to get in there. Yeah, historically, over the years, when those guys were buying hides at 5 cents a pound, I don't have the luxury of knowing how long that swing was from 5 cents to $1.25. But I mean, if you look at the percentage difference of what that would equate to in a finished leather price, that's substantial.
It says 25 years, which is still pretty insane.
Yeah, that's a huge swing. An absolutely huge swing. That is a full-blown problem, I think, from a standpoint of how do you price your product. But the nice thing was everybody that was there was dealing with the same thing. So we were all on par, you know, with the competitors. So, I mean, my grandfather was a really savvy buyer. He would buy really aggressively when prices would seem to be low. And he got very good at timing that. My father did the same thing. They got very good at being able to have material coming in and be able to hold product for an incredibly long period of time. And I guess I was fortunate to be involved in a family business that they had the luxury of being able to go into the market and basically control what they needed to do for their own productions. They didn't have to, wasn't going to stop us. They just kept buying, which helped. I think in the long run, though, you know, as a business model, as long as we were selling, it wasn't a big deal. But when the volume started to drop, it got a little difficult.
I imagine. We're going to temporarily, I might get back to it, stop grilling you about things that were 100 years before you were born. About a year ago, you relaunched Galoon Leathers. What's that look like? How'd it happen?
It was one client that reached out asking if I could reproduce a product we used to make at the tannery. I told them, honestly, I wasn't sure what I'd be able to do, but let me dig into this and I'll get back to you. So we pulled the formulas. The first thing that became very apparent was that some of the products in the finish systems are not capable of being reproduced because over 20 years had passed and things were not the same. So being able to reproduce it was not going to be as easy as we had hoped. Obviously, there's multiple factors that go into making a piece of leather, less of which when you're beaming the product, we had a very specific beaming process that was unique to Galoon. I now had to go operate in more of a utility-based environment. So right there alone, there was going to be a difference in the quality of how things came out. Two, the retanned and the chemicals that were going to be used didn't exist anymore. There were different versions of it. So we had to do a lot of experimenting in R&D to get something that we felt was marketably close and almost identical, I guess, as identical as it was going to get. So we were able to do it, but it took us almost 2 years to where we felt we could follow our hand at it. I mean, there was a lot of work involved in that, but we got it. So I feel good about that.
Probably don't have 700,000 square feet anymore. Where is this all taking place?
When I originally started on this process, I went to Ryan Law and I asked him if he'd be willing to work with me on this project. So he was like, yeah, absolutely. In our backyard, fortunately, I'm able to work with Law Tanning. I'm able to process my my beaming operation through a commercial operation called DR Dietrich, which is nice. Working with a gentleman by the name of Ross McKinnon, great guy. He helps do the best he can with my small, delicate little skins compared to the giant cattle hide he processes on a regular basis. He's been very helpful helping me evolve this stuff. We process our beaming process along typically with deer, which needs to be handled a little bit more delicately and sit a little longer. So it actually has helped our beaming process with that addition working that way. It works very well for the calfskins and helps reduce some of the draw and some of the typical problems when you run fast with the operation. So we take it from there and we take it over, grade it at Law. We process, split and shave and get it ready for our customers through their beaming operation. But like anybody, you hate to see things disappear. And when that opportunity came, and it was just one opportunity, but from there, I've developed probably a dozen new articles, six of which I have regularly out to offer to clientele.
Quickly, before we get into those, you mentioned the beaming process a couple of times. Could you just clarify that terminology for everybody listening?
We get our wet salted hides from the abattoirs we work with. And that's another issue that I found to be kind of interesting because their veal used to be a very big part of the diet back in the day. There aren't very many veal producers anymore. So finding hides, at least domestically, is difficult. The Europeans still have it, and we use both European and U.S. hides, but it gets to be a little bit harder to find raw material. So anyways, we bring in these wet salted hides and then we dehair them in Milwaukee here with the help of Ross McKinnon and Dan Dietrich's facility. And then we process that to wet blue, or we take it to pickle, depending if we're going to do chrome or if we're going to do veg. We'll pre-process there. From there, we, depending on what we're going to be making, the chrome products I do almost exclusively at Law. And then my veg products, I work with another gentleman by the name of Danny Uribe, who has a tannery called Legacy.
Why is it called beaming?
Have you ever seen any of the old photographs where they're actually taking the flesh and the fat off the backs of hides when they're fleshing it? They used to lay it across a beam. So I'm assuming it might be as simple as that. What we do mechanically now with a flesher, they used to do by hand.
Let's take a quick break. Really excited to talk about the leather you're making and a ton more. But we'll be right back with Egg Galoon on the ShoeCast. Over the past 3 years, Spokane's own Nick's Boots has been innovating with exceptional leathers, first-class American tanneries like Wicked and Craig and Seidel, and new styles like their Tactical, Chelsea, and Western boots. Palouse! But deep behind the scenes, Nick's has been cooking up something else. Something secret. Something totally different than anybody has ever seen from Nick's before, including me. They haven't shown me anything, not a picture, because they consider me to be a leak risk, which is, you know, kind of get that. So I'm endlessly excited to get a look at whatever it is that they're cooking up. They just keep telling me it's really good. At our boot camp event this October 6th and 7th, 2023 in New York City, which you should come to. You should definitely come to this thing. It's going to be good. So I hope to see you and Nick's and whatever it is they're whipping up over there in the Skunk Works this October. And now, back to the ShoeCast. All right, we're back with Egg Galoon of Galoon Leathers. Let's talk about what you're making. Like, I've handled, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 articles right now, maybe a few more. But let's start with the calf, which, you know, is kind of the namesake product. And is really, it's one of the coolest, most unique calf leathers that I've come across. Like, it's very different than maybe what you expect or accustomed to. Like, I would consider it not really delicate, as you see on a lot of calf leathers, but manages to also still have this level of refinement that you do expect from great calf. That was my bad job of describing it. How would you describe the various calf leathers that you're making right now?
The calf raw material is what it is. It's a very fine-grained, very tight-fibered product. No matter how we tan it, it's always going to have its natural characteristics. So I don't think we can make bad calf because it's a young, beautiful animal. It hasn't been alive long enough to get a lot of damage to it. That's what makes them rather unique and exclusive. I personally like to work with those types of materials. But you're right, we're not making a traditional protein-topped, very refined look. I'm trying to make very natural leathers. The second one, we had a product that the tannery used to make way, way back, brand-wise, called Viking Calf. And that's the one that, you know, featured first was Viking. It's a semi-chrome product that has about 20-22% veg extract in it, and the rest is chrome-based. We tried to make a product that literally we could almost not finish it and it could be put on a last and somebody could hand finish it. We went ahead and made this product. We do dyed bases. We'd add 2 layers of wax on it and then we'd do a mechanical bright plate to it. And just literally, it's pure aniline. You're seeing right to the grain. There's nothing there. We did a second iteration on that, which is Viking T-Core, which I'll have at boot camp. There was a big demand for a light-based leather with a natural base where we'll then stain the grain to whatever the client's customer demands are. Both semi-chrome, very traditional type tannage, makes an excellent piece of footwear. When you say a more durable, rugged look, it's because we're using a lot of natural waxes, where back in the day, and a lot of the Europeans use a protein type top, which is very delicate and sugary. Ours is a little bit more earthy, I guess would be the way to put it.
Much better than I said. But yeah, I mean, I 100% agree with that, right? Like, it's not this like perfect in the terms of everything is the same traditional box calf. I love that stuff too. Like, there's a time and a place for it, but I think especially in the boot world, which is a lot of where Galoon Leathers have been living so far, the idea of a calf is often tossed aside unless it's like a pure dress boot, when it actually, one, can be really interesting. But then I think the stuff that you're doing really adds another gear to it that just fits the footwear in a way that, I don't know, I don't think anybody else is really doing anything like it.
part of it is probably because I really enjoy the heritage styles myself. So I find myself trying to create products that I would think other people that like that type of footwear would like to see in a pair of boots or a pair of shoes. You know, maybe I'm guilty of being myopic like that, but that's where I tend to find myself going. With taking feedback from customers, the other thing that came up about a year ago was to make a wet stuffed piece of calf where it has some waxes and oils rolled into it. Similar topping system that we do on the Viking, but a different tannage, a little bit more lubricated. You know, you see a lot of different leathers out there that have a lot of waxes and oils in them, both in veg and chrome. So we did a semi-chrome wet stuff. We called it August calf. Very beefy, luxurious, round, almost a wet feel. It is gorgeous stuff. On the boot, it looks very similar, but it performs very differently on the last, only from the standpoint of because of how well lubricated it is.
Performs differently on the last. How?
The Viking tannage is a little bit drier. Not that it's dry, it's just drier. We've got a lot of wax and oil in the August tannage. It creates a little bit of a burst. We can control how much or how little we put in because I can make it really wet or I can make it very dry. We originally developed that for our wild boar tannage, which we intentionally made very, very greasy, wet. We wanted to make it a very unique leather. We succeeded. We've also done variations of that where we've backed out that amount of fat liquoring and oils, depending on the client. Sometimes they don't like working with them. They're that wet. With the calf, we don't go that heavy.
You mentioned that wild boar, which is also something that's quite different, I would say.
We had an opportunity with a client that was looking for something unique. And when we came across the raw material, and I said, well, let me make a sample up and let's see how it performs for you and see if it does something. It worked well in a Western boot. I was working with Oak Street with George Vlagos, and he did a series in them. When I saw the photographs come out of his product in that leather, I was blown away how cool they looked. We still produce that. It's kind of on a limited release basis, you know, as we get material available. There are some that we just toss out because they're just not good enough quality, but it's a really cool, unique product that makes for a very, very unique set of footwear.
You mentioned Oak Street. We mentioned Knix earlier. A lot of the stuff that I've handled is on Viberg product. Yeah, you're working with them. Anybody else in the footwear space?
I've been sampling into some kind of high-end Western boot guys. Stallion Boot, which is a gentleman by the name of Pedro Munoz. He's been looking for some different unique products. I've been using some of my lightweights for him on some pure aniline, and he also does a lot of finishing on the last. So we sell him like a grade 1-2, that T-core crust. He can take that really light natural color, and the level that these guys can finish at once they hand stain these, it's absolutely incredible. They look like nothing I've ever seen. They put a patina on these things and changed the product so dramatically, you wouldn't have guessed where it started from to where it ended up. But I've also seen that done with some of the guys in New York. There's some footwear guys there that I'm always amazed once they get done patinaing these shoes, you're just like, how in the world did you go from there to there? It's truly an art form.
It's pretty wild. So one of them comes to you and says, here's what I want. Or you say to yourself, you know, what if we can make this thing that we've maybe never made? What does that development process look like? Like, how does it go with you?
Well, there's a lot of moving parts, obviously, in producing a piece of leather, from sourcing the raw material, working it through the beam house where they're, you know, you're neutralizing it all the way through the retans to finishing. There's a lot of steps that are required, you know, and every one of them can have a variance through human error to temperature, pH, you name it. There's a lot of things that can change and ruin a really nice hide. So I work with a lot of customers that don't bother to want to know the difference. They think they do. But when it comes down to it, I have to rely on guys that are so good at their jobs. And basically, they're high-end chemists that will be able to make sure that hide one looks like hide 1001. We've had issues in the past where literally, if someone's not paying attention to pH when we're beaming and they're neutralizing something and something doesn't go right, you can make tender leather very easily. And unfortunately, sometimes you don't realize it until you get it past retan and you've got basically junk. So you end up having to toss it out. And it doesn't happen often, but it does happen on occasion. But there's a lot of expertise that's relied upon. Some of it's beyond my ability. I have to rely on other people because I work in a contract environment. So I have to basically make sure that these guys are doing. Now, do we try to ride shotgun to the best of our ability without being annoying? I don't want to be in some guy's face telling him how to do his job. But I do a pretty good job of trying to stay on top of what's there. And I test every load, making sure that we're making the best quality product we can make based on established standards.
So is the magic chemistry is the magic. Sorting is the magic. Making adjustments on the fly. Like leather, it's so prevalent. It's everywhere. And a lot of it is plenty good. And I mean, a lot of it's junk. But the idea of a nice piece of leather is just so commonplace that I feel like the mysterious process behind it is just kind of rarely considered.
My opinion, it starts at the very beginning with the raw material. You try to work with very reputable sources that really take care of their products. Pre-preparation, how these animals come out of the abattoir and how fast they're salted and prepared makes a big difference. It preserves the product in its natural state to the best of its ability, so we have time to be able to bring them here. High quality process and chemical controls is really, I mean, I'd say there's some trial and error involved in being able to get your processes down to where you feel comfortable being able to repeat them. During COVID, there was a lot of problems with being able to get chemicals. You were forced to either have to wait, and time isn't always on your side, especially with raw materials. So, I mean, they're salted, so you can get them in. But on occasion, I do buy green hides with no salt on them. So they're literally going from abattoir into blue very, very quickly. So there, I don't have that luxury. But the magic portion of this thing, I think, is just literally making sure your quality controls at every level and trying to use the best quality products you can get your hands on, because it shows in the finished product. You made a comment that makes a lot of sense to me. It resonated with me that some of them are just crap. And I mean, on occasion, bought on price for customers because, hey, this is what they wanted. This is what they wanted to pay for. And they're never happy. So I think the minute you start cutting corners and start sacrificing anything in quality, it's going to show. And then your customers' products will show those shortfalls. I've made an effort to not concern myself necessarily with buying the cheapest. I try to make myself very open to buying the best I can get my hands on, whether it's raw material, chemicals, what have you. And I mean, I work very closely with the tanners and the retanners and the finishers, basically making sure that we're maintaining our quality levels at a level that makes us unique and different, because the product will be better. So it's magic to keep it going every day, but
didn't want to minimize all that hard work with the term magic. Illusions, Michael. Illusions.
I've met some tanners that can make a solution out of something that I because they've got 40 years experience. I had a problem with something and I reached out to a gentleman who's basically retired now. And I said, here's my problem. What would you suggest where I should start? In about an 8-minute conversation, he gave me two suggestions, and his very first suggestion worked. I mean, I've been doing this a long time, and he knew what to narrow it down to.
Love that. What's the craziest leather you're pretty sure you'll make one day or want to make?
I'm in discussion right now with a colleague. We're talking about producing hopefully a commercially viable version of the world's largest antelope called an eland. We've done some sampling and testing on these. We're trying to see about commercially being able to get these on a regular basis before we make any type of introduction. So that would probably be the most unique hide of recent that we've been working with.
Interesting. So it would be maybe similar to kudu or deer, but maybe not?
Similar, bigger, thicker. I would put it in the category. These on the hoof, these weigh 1,500 to 2,000 pounds.
Oh, damn.
They're just a gigantic antelope is really what it boils down to. It's a really good red meat, very lean. I'm working with a gentleman who's got a consortium of ranchers that are talking about trying, I won't say they'll domesticate these, but be able to make a meat business on a specialty level. And I told them I'm interested in the hides, and we're trying to see if we can make this work.
Well, these guys are no joke. They are stacked.
The grain of the material is very interesting, but it's a wild animal. So like what you've seen in kudu, you can imagine will be very similar where they get the scratches and what have you, because they're roaming around in these ranches that might be 1,000 acres or plus.
Eland, why is Polish horse leather the best, if it is indeed the best?
I think it's the breeds that are coming out of there. I think they're a larger draft animal. We've tried to source some ourselves for clients. There's a lot of demand for it. The Italians and the Japanese have really good sourcing in there, and I'm sure Horween as well are very familiar with these European hides. And they're for us, they're hard to get. And that's not really our core business, but I see the horse butts and the shells that come off of these animals, and they're gorgeous. They're big. I've worked with some other raw material sources in the past where the animals are quite a bit smaller. They don't make a good shell, but they would work fine for like a garment.
Are there any other kind of hides that are renowned for being fantastic that come from a certain place?
I produced a product for a client that's making baseball gloves that requested German bulls. they're really, really nice. They're incredibly big, incredibly thick, and very, very clean. Expensive, in my opinion, probably one of the cleanest, nicest bovine hides I've ever seen in my life.
The BMW of bulls.
Yep.
Okay, let's drastically oversimplify things for this one. What are the differences between good leather and bad leather?
Wow. All right.
I mean, this could be a whole episode. So.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the reason I work in the medium of calf is because I like the fine grain. I like the nature of it. I'm always trying to push the envelope and make it something that it's not. But what makes a good leather to me, it starts with the raw material. The higher quality, the better it is. The tannages can make a real difference because I'm sure you've handled leather where you touch it and you're like, eh. Or you're like, ah. I mean, that's just a factor of the time and effort by whoever produced that leather to make it into something that made it very, very unique and wonderful versus somebody who cut a corner. And you can actually tell by touching it and looking at it. But I've seen some bad leathers in my day because I've got clients from the past that wanted to pay only X amount of dollars. And when you start doing that, you start cutting corners. And it's usually in grades, usually on how it's handled, usually what's going into it. And you're usually trying to cover up anything natural about it. So you end up making a substandard product by price. Those are the kind of things that I think make the difference between good and bad.
We got to pick one. We got to say raw material, the grades of that, or the tanning process, which can be everything. It could be equipment, it could be procedure, it could be timing, chemistry. When you touch that leather that you're like, I guess this is leather, probably, and not like paper. Is that coming more from one of those sides, like the failure of it?
Well, the failure of it will be obviously in the tannage side. I mean, you can ruin a piece of leather with a bad tannage. I mean, they can go tender, they can go brittle. Tender is usually the biggest problem with them. They'll basically tear. A guy would put it on a last and, you know, tries to pull it over the last and it just, you know, essentially just tears right off. But if you start with good quality raw material and you have a good tannage, you should be able to make a really nice, you know, piece of leather. In the past, I've worked with a number of different raw material sources. And I used to work with a gentleman in Nigeria who used to pit tan goat skin. I was like, how are we going to be able to take that medium and turn it into something useful? Because when you see it pit tanned, it looks like a potato chip. They're awful. But if you know how to handle it from there to the next phase, you can make it absolutely gorgeous. That is the difference, I think, on the chemical side, where you can take something you would think would be no good and turn it into something absolutely incredible. So I'd say, in my opinion, the tanning really can upgrade a piece of leather to a point that it's marketably acceptable and actually high quality.
Nice. That's helpful. Kind of the same question, but more specific. What are the differences between good footwear leather and bad footwear leather? And is that different than the answer that we just got?
It can be different because I've owned footwear that I like the look of them, but I don't like to wear them because they don't break in the way I like to wear them. I mean, that's just a personal choice. But I've had tannages that don't wear well, very brittle, firm leathers. And I mean, I'm not trying to knock on shell, but shell takes a long time to break in. And I've got a couple pairs of shell boots and it took me a year and a half to get them to where I felt like I could wear them. And I'm not knocking shell, but it's just the fiber structure such that it doesn't break in very quickly. To me, that's a hard leather to wear.
So temper and kind of firmness and all that to you, like especially through a lasting process, you know, whether it's machine or hand lasting, from your perspective as a tanner, presuming that, you know, looks good, is that really the most important part of great footwear leather?
I was out in Spokane trying on some boots just for the sake of it. And these things were like 9-ounce line boots I'm like, oh my God, these things are just crazy. But I got to take an account. These guys are, you know, they're working a forest fire in the middle of nowhere. They can't have a failure. So that's why I understand why they build the boots the way they do. So it's hard for me to look at that and go, oh, well, that's not casual footwear. That's performance footwear. I try to get that out of my head when I'm answering this. I've bought footwear in the past or been given footwear in the past as prototypes and trials and realized why I didn't like what we'd produced. I think a lot of it comes down to our customer's customer, giving them feedback of what they like and what they don't like. And as long as there's that open line of communication, we can usually evolve a product to work better, both in the factory and for their customer's finished product. But I have seen some products that we produced that I didn't like. It just didn't work well. When it left the tannery and was, I thought it was an excellent piece of leather. It can go a variety of different ways based on what expectations are. And I guess on the table, sometimes things look better than they do in the finished product. That's where we got to be open-minded as a manufacturer to be able to say, yeah, well, you're right. We didn't make exactly what we were supposed to do.
I think it's a really good way to look at it. Do you know of any instances of leather that's great for other purposes, but terrible for footwear? Like, it just doesn't translate for whatever reason.
We've traditionally tanned deer skin that I, you know, you see in a piece of footwear just because the typical tannages you see tend to get very soft and baggy. I just don't think it translates well into footwear, but I've seen it. I just don't think it works well. And a deerskin glove or a deerskin jacket, you know, there it has perfect application, but in footwear, I just don't think it does. Now, that being said, we've produced a product, and I know you've seen it, with a very, very unique tannage that is meant for footwear on deerskin. But we took everything and everything conventional about deerskin out of deerskin. It'll be available at boot camp, by the way, our Teton Stag.
I mean, I don't know if I have to edit this out. Were we allowed to say who did that?
Well, he hasn't told me not to say anything about it.
All right, just say it.
Yeah, Wyatt Gilmore, Grant Stone. So I believe he's going to have them at your event.
That's what I've been told. I saw him in New York about a couple months ago. I saw Wyatt, but also the boots with this leather. It's really cool. It's got gears to it. Like, it stands out on a shelf, that's for sure.
That's 2 years worth of R&D that went into that. And we took all the conventional knowledge and threw it out the window. You're going to meet Dan. He's going to be in my booth. To be able to come up with something like that, it took a lot of effort and trial and error to basically make something that nobody's ever made before. And it's so proprietary that it's so cool, it's weird.
Very distinctive. Ton of character. Can't wait for everybody to see it. All right, here we'll cap it off with a simple one, which you're going to nail. What do you think the American tanning industry, which has been through all sorts of ups and downs, since that document was published in 1958 about all the ups and downs of the previous 100 years, what does it look like in, let's call it, 20 years?
Yeah, I mean, as far as the way I see it, the way I've built the current Galoon Leathers is to be very bespoke, customer-oriented, not so commoditized. As far as an industry, I sure hope it gets stronger and bigger, and I hope more manufacturers start coming back this way. I mean, I'm starting to see a resurgence of high quality footwear and accessory manufacturers here in this country. And I hope that trend stays. You know, for lack of a better word, I deal with a lot of clients offshore and I'm always blown away at the prices they can offer. And I, not that cost is everything, but I think it sacrifices quality. But I think we're starting to get a resurgence here in this country where quality really makes a big difference. And I think the end consumer is starting to realize when you can resole a boot and keep it for a number of years rather than getting your footwear and just throwing it out when the sole is done. I like the fact that there's a resurgence coming into that. In 20 years, I don't know. I mean, I that's my wish. I'd like to see that happen. I hope my wish crystal ball is as clear as can be. I just don't know. But that's what I'd like to see happen.
Crystal balls and magic, Ed. That's what we're working with here. I love it. Look, we got to call it somewhere. Huge thanks to Nick's Boots for sponsoring this episode. Stay tuned for their very secret, cool boot project thing that they're making me keep a really tight lid on, that they'll unveil at our boot camp mega event in NYC this October 6th and 7th, 2023, if you're listening to this in the future. Ed, thank you so much for coming on, man. This was an absolute gas. Can't wait to see you in October. But thanks for having this chat and just, yeah, getting all this out there and doing what you're doing. It's cool. Like, the idea of, you know, a U.S. micro tannery making some of the coolest leather you've ever seen. Nobody predicted that one 3 years ago. I'm thrilled you're doing it.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun.
I agree. That's it for this week. Take care of your shoes. We'll see you next time.